It's Wednesday, June 24th, and the world is moving fast enough that it's easy to miss the gears grinding underneath. Today, we're looking at why the U.S. diplomatic strategy in the Gulf is falling apart, how the AI industry is finally waking up to the cost of its own hype, and the reality check hitting the sports business world. Here's the thing about the U.S. diplomatic effort in the Persian Gulf. It's currently defined by what can only be described as a systemic failure of process. The administration has largely abandoned institutional expertise in favor of a no-bid, gut-driven decision-making style. This has effectively turned a complex geopolitical crisis into an unmanaged liability. They're banking on a model of Kushnerism, which assumes that regional religious and historical identity will always take a backseat to shiny new condos and tourism. Meanwhile, the reality on the ground, Khomeinism, is a rigid ideology-first framework that fundamentally rejects Western commercialism. By trying to purchase peace with economic concessions, the administration is ignoring the fact that the other side is still operating on a foundational revolutionary mandate. It's a strategic mismatch, and it's getting worse. The structural fallout here is pretty bleak. By relying on foreign intelligence, specifically Mossad assessments of regime fragility, rather than the consensus from the CIA, State Department, and Treasury, the administration has built itself a nice, cozy echo chamber. This is exactly how you end up with policy disasters like the failed expectation that aerial bombing would trigger a popular uprising in Iran. To make matters worse, they've sidelined the Secretary of State in favor of the Vice President, creating a massive diplomatic vacuum. You end up with a circus where private assurances are immediately disavowed in public. And perhaps most dangerously, they've linked the opening of the Strait of Hormuz to the status of Hezbollah in Lebanon. That basically gives an Iranian-backed militia veto power over global energy markets. It turns a regional skirmish into a potential global economic catastrophe, which honestly is a hell of a gamble to take when you don't actually have a plan for what happens next. Domestic politics are also feeling the squeeze. The American political landscape is drifting further away from the material reality of the average citizen, largely triggered by a foreign policy that prioritizes massive military spending, roughly $1 billion a day, over domestic stability. We're seeing a total failure to address the basics like housing and healthcare, while traditional party loyalties have devolved into either cultish devotion or purely transactional arrangements. The result is a political environment that's becoming increasingly reactionary. If the parties don't start addressing the cost of living, they're just going to keep pushing voters toward the fringes. Moving over to the markets, we're seeing a narrative built on peak rates and peak inflation. Investors are feeling pretty good because oil prices are down and the U.S. consumer is holding steady. But there's a massive speculative bubble hiding in plain sight. We've seen a surge in AI infrastructure spending. We're talking about 2.5% of U.S. GDP, without seeing any matching revenue from the hyperscalers. The market is essentially funding a massive expansion based on hope. If these companies can't turn that infrastructure into actual productivity gains, we're looking at a correction that will make past tech bubbles look like a minor inconvenience. The Federal Reserve isn't helping matters either. They're shifting toward a communication style that is basically code for, "We're going to stop giving clear guidance and just watch how you react." When the central bank stops being the primary setter of policy and starts acting like a spectator, it creates a policy vacuum. If rate volatility returns, the fragile balance supporting the financial sector will likely collapse. Across the pond, the UK is dealing with its own brand of political volatility. We've gone from 17 years of relative calm to a decade of what looks like permanent gridlock. The current discussion around potential leadership changes reflects a shift from technocratic governance to a model based entirely on charisma and internal party management. The problem? Any incoming leader in this environment inherits a manifesto they didn't write, stuck between rigid fiscal rules and pressure from a base that wants a clean slate. It's a classic case of prioritizing party morale over a long-term strategy. When you change leaders through internal lobbying instead of elections, you're just accelerating the erosion of public trust. In Australia, the Albanese government just managed to push through a tax reform package by cutting a deal with the Greens. They're closing a loophole that allowed retirees to use self-managed super funds to borrow against residential property. It's an attempt to cool down the housing market, though it's largely incremental. But the bigger story is the government's willingness to trade regulatory loopholes for legislative speed. We're seeing this tension elsewhere too, like the decision to keep the herbicide paraquat legal, despite a 29-year review and warnings about health risks. It's a clear sign of a government trying to balance industrial utility against long-term public health externalities. On a more scientific note, researchers have identified an interstellar comet, 3I/Atlas. It's made of carbon that predates our solar system. It's a rare physical record of the galaxy's earliest stages of star formation. It's a necessary reminder of just how much we don't know about the origins of our own neighborhood. Finally, we need to look at the Ebola outbreak in the DRC. According to reports cited by analysts, the situation involves over 1,000 confirmed cases with a 50% mortality rate. The reason this is such a disaster is that the virus reportedly circulated undetected for months because it's a strain that standard diagnostic tests didn't recognize. We lost the early warning advantage, and now health officials are playing catch-up. While some analysts project that without serious intervention, we could be looking at 20,000 infections by August, this is a direct consequence of cutting foreign aid programs that previously funded local surveillance networks. When you pull the plug on frontline observers, you aren't saving money. You're just paying for it later with an exponential increase in the resources required to contain a crisis. We're currently looking at a situation where only half of all contacts are being traced. And lastly, in Albania, a luxury resort project linked to Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump is causing a massive headache for the government. It's planned for the Zvornik region, which is a protected ecosystem with 250 bird species. The government allegedly bypassed EU environmental protections to clear the way for construction, which is a massive gamble, considering Albania is trying to join the European Union. Between the opaque shell company structures and the fact that prosecutors have already frozen accounts of a firm involved in the project due to fraud investigations, this whole thing is starting to look like a massive political liability. It's a perfect example of what happens when a government chooses short-term, foreign-backed development over the rule of law. They're trading their institutional credibility for a hotel project, and that's a shitty deal for anyone trying to build a stable country. That mess in Albania is a good segue into how tech projects are being handled or mishandled elsewhere. The enterprise AI landscape is hitting a wall, and it's a math problem. Companies are finally realizing that running every single task through a frontier model is a fantastic way to incinerate their profit margins. Because these agentic workflows run in continuous loops, the token costs are outpacing the actual value of the output. The move now is toward open-weight models. The strategy is to stop overpaying for intelligence you don't need and start matching specific tasks to smaller, specialized models. We're looking at a future of task SOTA models, where you use one engine for PDF parsing and another for front-end coding. Even Microsoft is reportedly sniffing around companies like DeepSeek, which tells you everything you need to know about how the big players are trying to hedge their bets against being tethered to a single lab's pricing. The era of subsidizing indiscriminate AI usage is over. If your business isn't auditing its workflows for complexity right now, you're just lighting money on fire. Meanwhile, the local backlash against data centers is getting loud, but the actual data is a bit more nuanced than the headlines suggest. Critics are throwing around massive numbers, like a facility using 300 million gallons of water a year to stir up the pot, which honestly sounds scary until you realize that leaky pipes in the US waste over 3 trillion gallons annually. The real issue isn't that data centers are inherently evil. It's that our local grids and infrastructure policies are stuck in the 20th century. There is a middle path here. In Richland Parish, Louisiana, a Meta project actually resulted in $50,000 teacher bonuses through local tax ordinances. When communities stop looking at these projects as environmental threats and start negotiating them as infrastructure partners, they can actually get something out of the deal. If the U.S. keeps treating this as a binary choice, total submission or total rejection, we're going to lose our technological edge to global competitors. It's a negotiation problem, not a resource apocalypse. That shift toward utility is bleeding into the markets too. Wall Street is finally cooling off on the speculative AI hype and starting to care about actual boring things like recurring revenue. You can see it in how SpaceX recently raised $20 billion in a bond offering. Credit investors don't care about your AI vision. They want to see cash flow. Venture capital is pivoting in the same direction. Menlo Ventures just raised $3 billion, and they aren't looking for another generalist chatbot. They're acting more like technical partners, providing compute access and domain expertise to companies that are actually building industrial tools, like Siemens using engineering agents to automate factory programming. The market is consolidating. If you're a company still relying on a hype-driven narrative instead of physics-based value, you're going to have a really shitty year when the public markets finish their current correction. Finally, we're seeing a shift in how AI is being introduced to the public, at least at the University of Baltimore. Their Center for AI Learning and Community-Engaged Innovation is trying to move away from the top-down implementation that usually ends in a public relations disaster. They're hosting town halls to figure out why people are actually resisting these tools. Here's the thing. Resistance isn't usually ideological. It's a reaction to a complete lack of transparency. When institutions ignore the guardians of a community, they end up with a literacy gap that kills adoption. The university is trying to act as a neutral intermediary, helping translate complex tech into something that actually addresses live needs, like using AI wearables for real-time overdose intervention. It's a coordination problem, not a technology one. If you want people to trust your systems, you have to stop acting like the gatekeeper of knowledge and start acting like a facilitator of discovery. It's a low bar, but based on how most of these rollouts go, it's apparently a very hard one to clear. When we talk about systems, we're also seeing major shifts in how we evaluate performance, whether it's in technology or on the track. Royal Ascot is officially the bellwether for the Breeders' Cup at Keeneland. That's the takeaway from recent data, which suggests that if you're still handicapping international races using raw speed figures, you're basically burning money. Here's the deal. European turf racing usually rewards a controlled pace followed by a massive 2-furlong burst. American dirt racing? It's the total opposite. It's a constant grind that pushes horses to their physical limits early, which is exactly why you see so many pace collapses. The data shows that horses like Mission Central, who won the King Charles III Stakes, are brilliant on straight tracks, but could be total liabilities when they hit the tight bend-heavy configuration at Keeneland. If a horse relies on a point-and-shoot style, they're going to get swallowed up by the tactical traffic you get on an American track. There's a clear divide here. While horses like Ombudsman show the stride frequency and speed reserves to potentially bridge that gap, others, like Notable Speech, struggled at Ascot, precisely because their rhythm didn't mesh with the course geometry. The bottom line is that trainers are now treating the Breeders' Cup as a distinct, season-long objective. It's no longer just about who is the fastest in June. It's about who has the mechanical efficiency to sustain a high gallop on firm, fast ground in the fall. Moving over to the Mid-Atlantic, the meet at Colonial Downs is presenting a different kind of puzzle. The track is drawing massive competitive fields, and the betting public is consistently overbetting favorites in maiden and claiming races. If you're looking for value, the reports suggest you need to stop obsessing over simple win bets and start hunting for inefficiencies. We're talking about horses shipping in from higher quality circuits that fly under the local radar, or horses switching to riders like Diego Herrera or Samuel Marin. The public loves a jockey upgrade, sure, but they're still ignoring distance limitations, like horses consistently running past their ideal 5-furlong range. It's getting crowded in the space, too. Platforms like In the Money Media are flooding the zone with granular visual grids and complex wagering strategies, which honestly just means the game has evolved. It's not about finding the best horse anymore, because everyone has the same data. it's about solving the puzzle of the price point. Whether it's the high-stakes transition from Ascot to Keeneland, or the daily churn at Colonial Downs, the lesson is the same. Stop looking at the results sheet and start looking at the mechanics. If you aren't accounting for how a horse handles a turn, or why a horse is being pushed beyond its ideal distance, you're just guessing, and that's a shitty way to spend your bankroll. That same drive for efficiency is dominating the professional leagues too. The sports business landscape is currently defined by a move toward extreme consolidation and high-stakes asset management. In the NBA, the league is seeing a shift toward defensive-focused rosters and financial flexibility as teams navigate the new collective bargaining agreement. Meanwhile, as the NBA draft approaches, front offices are focusing on the mid-lottery, where teams face high-variance decisions regarding injury histories and development potential. The draft's late first round is also shifting, as NIL deals keep top college talent in school, forcing teams to pivot toward the international pipeline for a long-term upside. Over in global soccer, FIFA has standardized 3-minute hydration breaks across all 104 matches of the current World Cup. While the policy is framed as a safety measure, it functions as a new high-value commercial inventory, generating an estimated $250 million in ad revenue for broadcasters. It's effectively turning soccer into a four-quarter game, and given the massive return on investment for rights holders, it's unlikely these breaks will disappear, even in cooler climates. The multi-club ownership model is also gaining steam. Bill Foley, who built a portfolio spanning the NHL and international soccer, is now eyeing an NBA expansion team in Las Vegas. The strategy is simple. Own the infrastructure, like T-Mobile Arena, and stack it with multiple leagues to dominate regional markets. Conversely, in professional tennis, the ATP is struggling to unify its men's and women's tours. Despite the potential to double or triple revenue through pooled media rights, the industry remains locked at a stalemate, paralyzed by the rigid complexity of tournament formats and asset ownership. In the gambling space, FanDuel is doubling down on its core sports betting business while shedding distractions. Specifically, it has shut down its media arm, FanDuel TV. The company is leaning into regulatory transparency, positioning its platform as a de facto integrity monitor that tracks transactions to deter illicit activity. They are also experimenting with prediction markets in states where traditional sportsbooks are restricted, using them as a hedge against regulatory uncertainty and an entry point for new users. Finally, in the corporate world, there has been speculative chatter regarding Ryan Cohen's interest in the retail sector. Though reports of a $56 billion bid for eBay remain unverified and inconsistent with current market valuations. It's a lot, but the through line is clear. Whether it's shifting tactical rosters, FIFA's new ad slots, or private capital hunting for sports teams, everyone is trying to squeeze more certainty out of an increasingly expensive, fragmented market. And speaking of business models, the world of media is undergoing a similar, often painful transformation. Evan Armstrong, the creator behind the newsletter The Leverage, has outlined a new blueprint for independent media. It's a business model built on three pillars: subscriptions, advertising, and consulting. Here's the reality of it. Despite his initial goal of leaning on subscriptions, the bulk of his revenue actually comes from consulting work. The newsletter serves as a trust-building mechanism that lets him bypass the need to chase clicks or pander to advertisers. Because he outsources his ad sales, he keeps enough distance to keep his opinions sharp. But there's a catch, and it's a big one. Armstrong compares this model to the restaurant business. Easy to open, but hell to keep running. The business is entirely tethered to his own output. Unlike a traditional startup that can survive a mediocre leader, if Armstrong stops producing, the business stops existing. Right now, he's trying to pivot to YouTube to automate his audience growth, because relying on manual labor to feed his newsletter and consulting work is, frankly, a recipe for burnout. It's a reminder that for all the talk of creator economies, the most successful ones are often just high-end, high-stress consulting firms in disguise. Moving over to the world of political reporting, the industry has become increasingly reliant on what are called rainmaker books. Titles like Regime Change by Haberman and Swan aren't just books. They are the economic anchors that keep publishing houses stable. they secure the retail shelf space and marketing muscle needed to subsidize smaller, riskier projects. But this has fundamentally altered the cadence of journalism. Reporters are now effectively managing assets rather than just breaking news. This creates a perverse incentive structure. Journalists are holding back significant findings from their daily reporting to ensure their books have enough exclusive material to actually sell. It turns the daily news cycle into a sort of long-tail commodity, where the real, granular details are locked behind a cover price. The trade-off is that while readers eventually get a deeper, more detailed historical narrative, they lose the real-time transparency that's supposed to be the point of the press. It's worth noting the specific way this rewards certain styles of reporting. The industry is currently optimized for nuggets, those viral bite-sized moments of political dysfunction that serve the algorithm well. We're seeing a shift away from the classic, detached, neutral newspaper voice toward long-form interpretive narratives. It's an admission that the traditional style of reporting has failed to capture the chaotic nature of modern politics. Look, I get it. The book format allows for a level of candor and depth that a 600-word daily dispatch just can't touch. But when the financial health of the media depends on delaying the release of critical information, the accountability aspect of journalism takes a backseat to the balance sheet. It's a shitty situation for the public. We're trading timely, necessary information for a more polished, profitable product that arrives months or years late. Anyway, it's a hell of a business model, provided you aren't the one looking for actual immediate transparency. If you're feeling the burnout from the news cycle, you aren't alone. The healthcare industry is leaning hard into AI. And according to Dr. Darshan Shah, the focus is shifting toward digital twins. By syncing lab data and wearable metrics, AI can now simulate how your specific biology reacts to meds or exercise before you actually try them, effectively turning your doctor into a coach and you into the system manager. But look, don't trade your common sense for a dashboard. The tech only works if your foundation is solid. Dr. Shah makes it clear that if you're trying to use advanced longevity hacks or peptides while ignoring your sleep, nutrition, and muscle mass, you're just wasting your time. Muscle, specifically, remains the primary engine for metabolic health and the best indicator of how you'll age. Speaking of aging, chronic stress is actively hacking away at your chromosomes. Research suggests that living in a constant state of yellow mind, that low-grade modern-day anxiety, shortens your telomeres by up to a decade. The fix isn't just relaxing. It requires stress fitness, or the ability to intentionally shift your nervous system into restorative states, especially right before bed. If you're doom-scrolling before sleep, you aren't recovering. You're just burning ATP at a deficit. That biological toll is getting worse, too. We're seeing a decline in cognitive performance in younger generations, which is being linked to the lack of human-to-human mentorship in screen-based learning. It turns out, when you keep a nervous system in a constant state of high alert, it stops prioritizing deep learning and starts prioritizing survival. The good news is that this is malleable. Whether it's through intensive therapy to address epigenetic trauma or just better HRV regulation, the system is trainable. You just have to decide if you're using your tech to regulate your biology or if you're letting it grind you into the dirt. Before we wrap, a few other things worth knowing today. First, check your credit card benefits. If you're paying a massive annual fee for a premium card, you're likely sitting on purchase protection that covers theft or damage up to $10,000 an item, which is a hell of a lot better than paying out of pocket when you drop your laptop. Space is getting crowded in a way that's actually dangerous. The Kessler effect is moving from a sci-fi concept to a real problem, where orbital debris causes a chain reaction of collisions that could eventually turn low Earth orbit into a giant, unusable junkyard. In the NBA, the classic immobile center is basically dead. Teams are now prioritizing big men who can pass and playmake, moving toward a style where the center is the hub of the offense, rather than just a guy standing under the hoop, waiting for a rebound. Cyndi Lauper's career is a masterclass in stubbornness. She kept her creative control by refusing to play the industry's typical game, which honestly is the only way to keep your work from turning into bland, corporate-approved slop after 30 years. Anyway, that's where we are. Take a breath, keep your head on straight, and I'll catch you tomorrow.